Hi, I'm Steve. I'm our senior pastor. Thanks for spending an hour or two together. It's really a gift for me to be with you. I hope you experience it that way as well. As you've heard, we're full on to our Christmas season. We call Light in the Darkness. We've had some very cheery, happy people up here today. I'm going to compliment them by being kind of like the downer of the morning. I'm going to try to tell some funny stories and have a good time up here. But today's going to be a little heavier, more serious talk than normal. But before I get to that, so that video we watched before I got up, I don't know about you, but I found it moving. That the message of the season, that God is on the scene in human history. There's brilliant light and springs of water, long-awaited freedom. It's so beautiful. It feels like such good news to think God has done something and is doing something that could leave us and our world liberated and healed, fearless. This is an incredible story that we're hearing and celebrating. But if you find that story either deeply hopeful or frankly incredibly naive and kind of hard to believe, then it might be, at least in part, because the kind of year our world seems to be having. I know that in a room this size, people are full of our mix of the difficult and the wonderful and just the plain old mundane, but our setting that we're in, well, to me at least, it just feels like it's been a dark year. I remember this moment in high school where my social studies teacher, Mr. Aida, announced to us that the Berlin Wall had come down and that the Cold War was over. And he was very excited by this. I didn't quite understand what it meant, but I remember being a little bit surprised, like a war that had kind of defined my whole childhood could just end, and like a coming down of a wall could mark that. And my teacher's point they wanted to impress upon us, that, and a lot of people were thinking this at the time, was that this whole new chapter had opened up for our country and for our world, that there was a possibility of a new age of peace and of prosperity with the United States as this kind of unchallenged superpower that would enjoy both dominance but also the opportunity to spread peace and goodwill throughout the entire earth. And maybe it was a little bit naive, but we found out again and again this century that if that was ever true, it certainly doesn't seem to be true anymore. There seems to be an irony in how many walls and big, long walls have gone up in the world since the Berlin Wall so famously came down. And this year in particular, whether it's news of terrorism or racism or mass shootings, there's a whole news feed flooding the air telling us that there is not peace on earth, that there's a lack of liberation and healing, and there seems to be plenty of cause to be afraid. Sometimes I don't know what to think and feel about all this. It's intellectually and emotionally confusing. It's kind of overwhelming. So I found myself thankful for the artists, the prophets in a way, people that are able to give voice to this moment of time that we live in and capture a lot of it. And I stumbled across an example of this recently that I'd like to share with you. You're going to hear in a moment this spoken word piece is by a poet named Amina Brown and a musician she works with sometimes named Michael Gunger. And they put together this piece called Advent for Weary Souls. About 2 or 3 minutes long. I'd love for you to have the opportunity to hear it. Here you go. Amina Brown and Michael Gunger recorded that back in November. It may strike you that it's not even up to date anymore. That, sadly, there's been this ready supply of more breaches in our confidence and trust since then. She says, sometimes it's hard to light the candle and drape the tinsel when Christmas seems not to unwrap gifts but wounds, reminding us of the things we've lost. But again, we find ourselves with these candles lit and here with this story of a baby that millions have audaciously claimed brought God and light and salvation here to earth. And Amina asks, what does Jesus have to say when the plot lines of our lives or the plot lines of our world don't seem to line up with the promise of that story? What does Jesus have to say when we still long for justice? Well, we've been finding our way toward Jesus and our shared longings this season by listening to some voices that predated Jesus. Those of the Hebrew prophets, called minor prophets because the books they and their students left behind are small. But these prophets were, in a way, the spoken word artists of their day and age, or spiritual and practical poets with loud and cranky voices. And they spoke at various times to two nations, Judah to the south, Israel to the north, that both had their roots in the ancient kingdom of Israel, formed under a trifecta of 11th and 10th century BC kings named Saul, David, and Solomon. They're legends in Jewish history, great leaders and heroes, and they built a nation, built a palace, and built a temple. But maybe the greatest achievement of their age and culture wasn't political or architectural, but theological and cultural. They were the beginnings of the development of an idea, maybe even an experience, of a personal and active God, of a lived and experienced monotheism that really the world had never conceived to that point. Their belief was of a God that ruled the entire world but took a particular interest in the affairs of ordinary humans, and that same God longed to see the world reshaped for peace and for justice. And so in came the prophets claiming to speak for that God amidst times they said had forgotten him. And the prophet we're going to meet today is the one up on our slide. His name is Amos. And other prophets spoke when their nation was on the verge of disaster, kind of trying to interpret their trying times. But Amos spoke to Israel at the height of its security and prosperity. It would be a little bit like if a prophet came to America at the dawn of our new millennium, when our power and affluence seem kind of unrivaled in the world. But Amos shows up on the scene, and he feels like he sees the cost of that wealth and affluence, and he sees undercurrents beneath it that trouble him. And here's some of what he has to say. There'll be some excerpts I'll read today. They're in your program. Here's the first. He says, "Listen to me, you fat cows living in Samaria, you women who oppress the poor and crush the needy, and who are always calling to your husbands, 'Bring us another drink.'" I should have given you a little heads up. Amos is kind of gruff. He's not what most of us would expect in a Bible teacher. He wasn't a religious professional or a writer or a philosopher. He was a working guy. He was a farmer and a shepherd. So in some of the traditional art, you'll see him with sheep and various figs and fruits and things like that. But Amos had this rich prayer life, and he felt like he was the one called to speak for God in his particular moment in history, but he still spoke like the kind of working guy he was, like in very stark terms, thus the lines like the fat cows and bring me a drink and stuff like that. So here's more from him, though. He says, "The sovereign Lord has sworn this by his holiness. The time will come when you will be led away with hooks in your noses. Every last one you will be dragged away like fish on a hook. You will be led out through the ruins of the wall. You will be thrown from your fortresses," says the Lord. "Go ahead and offer sacrifices to the idols of Bethel. Keep on disobeying at Gilgal. Offer sacrifices each morning and bring your tithes every 3 days. Present your bread made with yeast as an offering of thanksgiving. Then give your extra voluntary offering so you can brag about it everywhere. This is the kind of thing you Israelites love to do," says the sovereign Lord. This is kind of a head of steam here Amos has going. He, by the way, is not an Israelite, as he kind of mocks all these Israelites. He's from Judah. It'd be a little bit like if like a Canadian working guy got off his shift at the end of the day and started like shouting at New England about like what ignorant fools we all are. That pretty much is what it would have felt like here. And what Amos is so incensed by is pretty much two things. It's economic injustice and empty religion. I think it makes sense when you think about it that God would get kind of annoyed if God felt like there were half-hearted, misdirected, self-satisfied religious expressions. I mean, religion feels like it should be God's turf, and so it makes sense to me that God would have some people opinions about people's religious expression and think it's off sometimes. You get kind of annoyed and bothered by all of people's attempts to connect with God. But according to Amos, what bothers God even more is how people are treating one another, and specifically how society is treating its most vulnerable. There are these fat cats telling someone to bring them another drink while they have underpaid or exploited people on their payroll. And Amos talks about this and other examples that can be pretty easily brought into a contemporary expression. He talks about his society's equivalent of exploitative payday lenders, of ridiculous interest rates, of rushed foreclosures, of unnecessary spending on luxury goods, of taxes that are regressive and kind of put the burden of society on the back of low-wage earners. And turns out what angers God about all the empty religion he sees isn't just that people aren't doing it right, but that they try to do religion when they won't put in the hard work to do justice. And religion done by people who aren't trying their best to make a just society, Amos says, is a farce to God. Our next passage from Amos, he quotes God as saying, "I hate all your show and pretense. the hypocrisy of your religious festivals and solemn assemblies. I will not accept your burnt offerings and grain offerings. I won't even notice all your choice peace offerings. Away with your noisy hymns of praise. I will not listen to the music of your harps. Instead, I want to see a mighty flood of justice, an endless river of righteous living. Martin Luther King Jr. made this passage kind of famous when he quoted it often in speaking, including his I Have a Dream speech. He said, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-living stream." And King learned a thing or two at the child of a pastor daddy and studying theology up here at Boston University. Go Terriers. I see some UBU people. He applied this poetry to God's deep heart for economic opportunity and social justice for all individuals. God's happy with people. God meets people in our spirituality, Amos tells us, when we're part of shaping a just society that protects and empowers all people in that society, especially those who are currently unprotected or disempowered. And we find this is part of the Christmas story too. An unexpected part, but it belongs here as well. Kind of given us some reminders, some thoughts throughout this month about what the prophets seem to teach us at Christmas time. And the first four bits in your program, under those program notes in that heading, a review from the past 2 weeks with the various ways God seeks to be with people and bring encouragement and wholeness and kind of good, full, healthy lives. But there's this fifth one today that I added in there that says we want a God who's fed up angry. I think we actually want a God who's like that, as we'll talk about. We want a God who's fed up angry, but we also want one who's patient and good. And apparently, at least according to Amos, in God we get both those things. I think if we heard about a God who is satisfied with the state of the world we live in, we'd think something was wrong with God, right? If we found out that God wasn't outraged when a police officer sexually violated a woman in his community, we'd wonder, like, what kind of God are you? If we heard God wasn't angry when people opened fire in a school or when unceasing war drove millions from their homes, then we think, can we worship that God? If people cried out, hey, pay attention to what's happening to our young men. Don't you know that Black Lives Matter too? If God heard that and got defensive or just shrugged his shoulders, who'd want to believe in that kind of God? The prophets tell us, though, that God is riled up by these things and many more. That God's angered anytime God sees an affront to justice or human dignity or the world as God made it to be. God sees these things. God really passionately cares about these things. But Amos tells us God's got this big heart too. And God is apparently very patient as well. Here's one more bit from Amos, where Amos is asking God not to act out of that anger, even anger that we'd want God to have. It says, "The sovereign Lord showed me a vision," Amos says. "I saw him preparing to send a vast swarm of locusts over the land." It's like for an agricultural society, like the biggest threat they could imagine. It says, "This was after the king's share had been harvested from the fields and as the main crop was coming up. In my vision, the locusts ate every green plant in sight. And then I said, oh, sovereign Lord, please forgive us, or we will not survive, for Israel is so small. So the Lord relented from this plan. I will not do it," he said. And the passage goes on to describe God's plans to punish oppressors, God's plan to put a stop to the cold-hearted indifference that Amos sees. But Amos says, we can't bear that, God. We actually can't bear your punishment because we're really kind of all caught up in this together. We're all part of that culture that does this to people. And so if you wipe out the people complicit in injustice, like who would be left? And he says, we're so small, God. Could you consider forgiving us instead of punishing us to get rid of that injustice? And we said that we read that God changes his mind, that he relents. God hears his prayer and says, sure, I will find another way. I think we get this like complex combination that we actually really hope we'll find in God here. Because I think we want God to be angry. Much of the philosophy about God or gods that the world has produced has envisioned a God who's kind of above the fray, who's too mature, too removed from humans to really feel anything about what goes on amongst you and me. But I think we hope that God will not be like that, that God will have passion, kind of outrage for what goes on earth. But we hope, too, that God won't be angry with us. or God won't be angry with the people we love, or that God won't be angry with anyone who's innocent, or maybe at anyone who's guilty but didn't really mean to be. Maybe God can just get angry at like the most evil dictator we can conjure up or something. And I think God understands this as well. We seem to have a God who hates the heart and impact of evil, but out of compassion and out of wisdom is tremendously patient with it as well. More patient with the darkness in the world than most of us would be if we were in charge. I've been captivated for years by this notion that God loves and longs to see justice throughout the earth, but that God isn't about to start twisting arms and blowing stuff up to make it happen. That God's more likely to empower people like you and like me to pursue compassion and justice and reconciliation. So about 15 years ago, with these concerns in mind, my wife Grace and I had the opportunity to travel to what was for us the far ends of the earth, to a place where we had heard injustice was obvious, and to see what a peaceful and reconciling presence could do there. And so we spent 2 summers in Central Asia, where Western China meets the Muslim world. And as you'll see from the slide coming up, this meeting doesn't always happen very peaceably. 2 summers in a row, we signed up a bunch of American college students. We traveled by plane and by train and by bus and sometimes even by donkey cart to Central Asia, where we taught English. And our students lived with secular Chinese and Muslim Central Asian students. This whole experience was kind of a revelation for us. Everything about the place seemed kind of magical and beautiful to at least these Western eyes. But it's interesting because our presence seemed in some ways a revelation to them as well. These students who hosted us had grown up in segregated schools and neighborhoods. I think we often remarked while we were there, I'm looking at Becca who went with us, that it reminded us of like what we'd heard about the American South in the early 20th century. That like different people groups had sort of different schools, different ways of life. The Central Asian students growing up taught to resent the Chinese as colonists in their community. And the Chinese students are raised, taught to look down upon and discriminate against their Muslim neighbors. And we felt like God cared about this division and pain, that there was part of the hurt in the world that made God angry, and that we were there to make friends and to embody love and peace and to see if that could matter. Our hopes in some ways, I realized we were there, were ridiculous because we were so small. One night, this was really highlighted very vividly to me when my wife Grace and I were just making our way to bed in our little dorm room. We got a loud knocking on the door and looked out the peephole, and there was like this whole division of dressed Chinese police like at our door banging on it. And I opened the door because I felt like that was probably what I had to do. And like in they streamed, kind of yelling at us, pulling us out of our room, sort of going through all our stuff, tossing the room. And it was a frightening moment, right? And I thought, what is going on? Is this because we're Americans? Is this because we were followers of Jesus? Because we were both of those things, and both of those in that particular part of China at that time were considered to be kind of threatening or suspect. We wondered, I don't know, were they just bored? Were they like spying on this biracial couple? Were they like, did they have like a camera in our room? Like, were they perverted? Like, I had no idea what was going on, but I remember feeling, in addition to feeling kind of violated by that moment, remember feeling like, wow, we are so small. Like, how do we dream to somehow make some difference for peace and justice in this, amidst all these powers, this big complicated part of the world? What could we hope to do? In one sense, the answer to that was nothing. We left, and then 9/11 happened right away, and China labeled their Muslim minorities potential terrorists, and tensions inflamed further back and forth, and life hasn't in some ways gotten that much better in the city and region in which we're in since then. And yet we've heard some stories. We've heard stories of profound acts of friendship and peacemaking, in some cases from students we lived with who were moved by our team's visit. Those kind of supernatural stories of who could act that way in the midst of that conflict. We've heard stories of a business that brings empowerment and economic opportunity to people who really need it there and are not getting that kind of opportunity. And we think, wow, that's amazing that that happened. We've heard stories of young people on these trips who caught a whiff of God's desire to see peace and justice in the world and have taken their own next steps to be part of that dream. And we hear these stories, we feel like maybe we weren't so foolish after all. Like maybe our bit was really worth doing. And I think about these stories and the hard and fierce things the prophets have to say about societies that aren't working right for everyone in them, and ask, where does this leave us at Christmas time? Christmas time in 2015, where God seems to see and care. God seems familiar with the pain that we experience in our own personal lives and the pain that we hear Amina Brown lament in our opening today. And God says he's on the move for hope and justice, but we know that's happening in smaller and less complete ways than we would like to see in our lives or we would like to see in the world around us. What do we do about that? How do we think about that? How do we sit in that tension? A few weeks back on Friday, I read the Gospel of John from the Bible. I was curious about what the story of the life of Jesus that John tells would feel like if it wasn't taken in just kind of chapter by chapter, but all at once. I found this really a compelling thing to do. Like listening to Amina Brown, it kind of validated my experience of living in a broken world. Because in John, we read about Jesus constantly surrounded by human need. He's surrounded by people with all manners of disabilities, by blind people, by dead people, by outcast people, by ashamed people, by people who've run out of ideas for their public leadership, and by people who have just run out of wine at a wedding. And there are all kinds of mean and violent people around him as well, so that everything good he does is opposed at every turn. But then there is Jesus, sometimes quietly, sometimes quite loudly, working wonders, speaking truth, like touching people and healing them, touching a dead person and bringing him to life. And as I read about Jesus bursting on the scene as light in the darkness, I got a sense of what it would feel like to stay alive in this broken world of ours, and maybe even to be on the side of a God who made us to long for justice and peace and be part of bringing that to pass. And in particular, I saw three things in Jesus that I really want for myself, and I think maybe some of you will want as well, so I'll share them with you. The first thing I saw is that I saw Jesus lamenting. I was at a gathering last Sunday on our campus, hosted by a psychiatrist and a social worker in our community around mental health, depression, and Jesus, essentially. And there were a mix of people there. There were clinicians who treat people who are depressed. There are people who had experienced long-time depression and themselves or in family members. Some other people just curious. And one of the moving parts of the time was that we heard from a woman who had been quite heavily depressed for her whole adult life, essentially, is doing much better now, but still lives with kind of the awareness that that could come back and long-time depression. And in her work, she also helps treat those who are depressed in different ways as well. As we heard her story, she talked about what meant the most to her when she was at her lowest points of depression. So what was most helpful for her were not people that came along to try to fix her right away. She said she was kind of actually like deaf to even hear them. It was not particularly useful. But people who would one way or another just sit there and be with her in her darkest depression. She said that was the kind of most profound move someone made to start to let the light in. And as I listened to that, I thought, oh, this is something Jesus is really good at, to just be present to people. Jesus had one experience when a friend of his died, and interestingly enough, he told the friends he was traveling with, like, oh, I'm going to do a miracle. He was kind of hinted about it, and they didn't get it, so he was very direct. He said, he died, and I'm going to bring him back to life. It's going to be fine. And they're like, oh, okay, that's the plan. And they traveled, and he arrives, but then this is what happens when he gets on the scene, and he sees his two friends, Mary and Martha, grieving their dead brother that he plans on bringing back to life. It says, when Jesus saw her weeping and saw the other people wailing with her, a deep anger welled up within him, this angry God again, and he was deeply troubled. Where have you put him? He asked them. They told him, Lord, come and see. Then Jesus wept. A little like Bible trivia thing. It's the shortest verse in the Bible. It's kind of a memorable one too. Jesus wept. I don't know. I find it tremendously comforting, moving. That part of what God has to do when God shows up on the earth as a human being is just, to like let out a big sigh. The first thing Jesus does isn't immediately kind of fix every person and fix every problem and make the whole world whole, but that Jesus weeps. And this happens with Jesus in a few times, and sometimes in individual cases like this, sometimes over a whole city, where he just kind of mourns that people are doing things the way they're doing and it's not going very well. This is called lament sometimes, this kind of act of weeping, this speaking and feeling the truth about pain and suffering in a broken world. I read a book recently by a theologian named Sung Chan Ra. He actually used to live in Cambridge. He helped start a church that we're friendly with in Central Square. And he wrote about lament. He says, lament, apart from just being a healthy thing to do, to sit in the reality of pain we see, lament is also an act of protest, as the lamenter is allowed to express indignation and even outrage about the experience of suffering. But lament is this healthy and natural thing to do in the face of pain. It's sometimes the best way to let light in for people experiencing pain, and it's its own expression of protest, right? By sort of speaking the truth about something is, instead of the way something is, instead of covering over it. Jesus, in addition to lamenting, I see Jesus acting as well. One of these kind of iconic moments from Jesus' life, produces his own artwork. It's actually meant to be a kind of angry Jesus. He looks a little too old. He has a beard, but there is the whip in his hand. It comes from this story. In the temple area, he saw merchants selling cattle, sheep, and doves for sacrifices. He also saw dealers at tables exchanging foreign money. Jesus made a whip. I'll just read that again. It's kind of a shocking line. Jesus made a whip from some ropes and chased them all out of the temple. And he drove out the sheep and cattle, scattered the money changers' coins over the floor, and turned over their tables. In my kids' school, they would say Jesus needed a timeout, right? This would be a suspendable offense. But there Jesus is, like, in the temple, so outraged by what's going on there. And that's a whole story about the various things, various theories of why he was so outraged. But so outraged about what that expression of spiritual life in his people's community had come to, that he made a whip and drove people and animals out of the scene to restore it to kind of health, peace, and justice, like the temple it was meant to be, at least for that moment. Jesus all the time is acting for others' healing. He's acting for to include people who have been excluded from the story of God's work in the world. In the sort of climax of Jesus' life before he dies and his encounter with the biggest power broker he would ever meet, as the Pilate, the Roman governor of the area, makes sure these conversations around power and justice, and Jesus acknowledging that he's bringing a kingdom to life, which was the true version of the counterfeit Roman kingdom that claimed to bring the Pax Romana, the peace to all earth, and Jesus strongly implying to these power brokers of his time that he's the true king, that he's bringing the peaceable kingdom from heaven that Rome has failed to do. Jesus acting for justice, promising justice would come. So I think when it's within his range, we see Jesus doing something for people, lamenting, being with them their pain, but also expanding justice around him. But it's interesting because sometimes with Jesus too, we see that there's a time and a place to go in a different direction. Someone sent me an email a little while ago and was expressing some of what they do in their work and their parenting for kind of justice and service in the world. And they were describing some of the various things that was familiar they did in their work for others and ways they've tried to develop compassionate children, children who learn to serve others and seek the good in the world, seek justice in the world. And she said, but is there ever like a stopping point? Because I feel tired. Like, is there ever a time when you don't have to fix it all? Like, when you can kind of take a break and trust that God's going to take care of things, or maybe someone else is going to take their turn? Or is there, like, always more that I'm supposed to do? And I didn't really know what to say to her, because I resonated. I felt like that sounds hard. And so I prayed about what advice to give her, and then this Bible story came to mind, the last I'll share with you this morning. It's another moment in Jesus' life, where we read 6 days before the Passover celebration began. Jesus arrived in Bethany, the home of Lazarus, the man he had raised from the dead. A dinner was prepared in Jesus' honor. Martha served, and Lazarus was among those who ate with him. Then Mary, Martha and Mary, these two sisters that Jesus wept with in the other scene. Mary took a 12-ounce jar of expensive perfume from the essence of nard, and she anointed Jesus' feet with it, wiping his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance. But Judas Iscariot, the disciple who would soon betray him, said, that perfume was worth a year's wages. It should have been sold and the money given to the poor. Not that he cared for the poor, he was a thief, and since he was in charge of the disciples' money, he often stole some for himself. Jesus replied, leave her alone. She did this in preparation for my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. I think this is like one of the most compelling, beautiful scenes in the life of Jesus. It's fascinating. There's this woman who's taking her life savings, which in a moment of time before banking and all that was saved up in the form of this massively expensive perfume. And she felt, as Jesus' death was approaching, and Jesus was giving a lot of hints and talking about this, she just felt like the most beautiful thing that she longed to do, that she was moved to do, was to pour this over Jesus' feet. And from Judas' perspective, this is huge waste. And whether we, you know, believe John's narrative of kind of like sniping back at this disciple that betrayed them all, where he's like, he was just a thief. He wanted to steal that money for himself anyway. You know, so maybe there's just kind of like a real darkness in Judas's thinking and action. But even if Judas had meant what he said, that he said, oh, there's a more strategic use of this money. It could have been used to serve others. Jesus sees Mary's action, and all he has to say is, oh, that is so beautiful. He's so moved by her expression of love and kindness, even if it's quite impractical. Even if it like doesn't, on any practical level, like bring any justice to the world. That there's something about like a small, targeted, strategic act of love and beauty that itself like brings light into the darkness. It's like a beautiful thing that should never be shut down. I hear in the story that we're made not just to mourn and to fight, not just to lament and to act, but to notice and appreciate something that's beautiful, to notice and appreciate what is good and true. Sometimes even when we have it in our spirit to let come out of us what is good or true or beautiful. I'm so moved when this occurs. I got a little email this morning from an organization we give a tiny amount of money to that said, thanks to you, it's nice that they made me feel like it was thanks to me. They said, thanks to you, girls like Maya, they made up some girl's name, like are no longer in a brothel, you know, but they're free and they're not targeted for exploitation. And I thought, oh, it's such a moment of beauty to hear this news of like one girl rescued from slavery. Like, I don't know, there's a lot of other girls that need rescuing, but I treasure that moment. It's extraordinarily beautiful. I want to close reiterating like these three things we see in Jesus as invitations to us this Christmas. Three ways we can be present and alive when things look dark in us or around us. Three gifts we can both give and receive in a broken world. The first gift, I think, the first invitation is to lament, is to grieve what looks brutal and wrong to you. And I see this with my own children when something's wrong in their life, that my first move as a parent is to try and fix it right away. And like, they don't feel appreciative of those actions I'm doing like on their behalf. And I realize they just want me to be with them, right? And I think that's a gift we can both give and receive, to not try and fix everything around us, but to simply notice what's wrong. And as an act of emotional health, and maybe as an act as a kind of protest, to feel what we need to feel in the midst of a painful world, to grieve what looks brutal and wrong. Secondly, an invitation to restore, to act for what's right when it's in your power. Right, there's a lot of restoration, a lot of making the world right that seems so far out of our power. And so the invitation is to do the thing that seems within reach. Like, this church has no idea like how we're supposed to end the world refugee crisis or figure out who needs what kind of help and how to give it. But we're like, but we have this hunger to do what's in our power. And so, well, we will hold a gathering and we'll pray and we'll learn and we'll give. And when we meet someone in need, we'll see if we can rally help to do the thing that's within us, to act for what's right. And I think the final treasure, like that friend I was emailing with, the final invitation is to treasure, is to be filled with wonder and to even direct that wonder toward God, to praise God for the true and the good and the beautiful whenever we see it in this season, to just stop and appreciate and enjoy that space, that moment, to tell God thank you, to tell God we see that as an expression of God's beauty. We're gonna have an opportunity in a way to do that just now in the rest of our service, to sort of move in the direction of kind of lament or worship and treasure, depending on wherever you're at. We'll do that in three different ways during this time. The first is that we'll sing. There'll be the opportunity to hear the songs, our band comes up and plays, and to join in as we express all kinds of things. We express our desire to see God real and alive in a broken world, as we express appreciation for the signs of God's presence we see and the invitation for us to see more of that. And so we'll invite you to stand with us in a minute and to sing along or just listen to the words and see where that takes you. The second opportunity we'll have is to receive prayer. We have a group of people every Sunday who offer one-on-one prayer for people who would appreciate that as part of their experience. And they gather together before the service and ask if there's anything that God might want to do through their prayers in particular. And two things came to mind for them today. One was neck pain. They felt like if there were people struggling with neck pain today, that God might want to, through their prayers, encourage or heal you in some way. The second thing that came to mind as I prayed was a feeling of burden and people who want to find peace and rest during the season. Like, if that seems to uniquely describe you, they'd love to pray that God would help you find that peace and rest you're looking for and unburden you during this season. So if you'd like someone to pray for you for one of those two things or anything else, that after I pray, you can go out the glass doors and head left into our chapel, and there'll be people there to pray for you. And the last thing we'll do together is communion. We have two tables on the side, one in the back. They have on them unleavened bread and wine, which Jesus had symbolized his body and his blood given for us. It's a powerful experience we're invited to of God's presence to receive this, expressing that Jesus is with us, that we'd like to receive Jesus within us. And so there are tables on the side, have the crackers and the wine. On the back, there is a gluten-free option and juice instead of wine, if that would work better for you for any reason. We invite you at any point during the rest of the service to go up to one of the tables to take the bread, dip it in the wine or in the juice, and to go ahead and eat that in your own time. Could you stand with me for a minute while I pray for us? Bless you, God. I say, I love you. I say, I appreciate you. That you would see our earth and kind of what we've done with it and with each other, and that you'd care. That you'd be fired up and angry about what you see. But that you'd react out of that with such patience and compassion and love that you'd show up in person and start to rewrite history and redirect the course of this earth. God, if there's any way that you'd like to redirect our own journey today, I invite you to at least open up myself for that. I invite you to speak to us, to move us during this time. We pray that we would know that you're with us, that we'd sense something of the depth of your wisdom and love and kindness and light for us. Help us be open to whatever it is you have to give us. Amen.